Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Chunker. It's Friday, September 1st. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me remotely from the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online is Patrick Cassidy. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be, Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll have Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Andy Tomolonis from South Coast Today. We'll hear from Ann Wood of the Provincetown Banner and George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Now, a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the Islands. Patrick, let's get started with the trial of Adrian Loya. It's gotten a lot of coverage this week. I want to take a few minutes to really unpack this. I think one reason it's gotten a lot of attention is because it's the kind of crime that we certainly don't often see here, maybe nobody sees often. It appears to be thoroughly premeditated and just horrific. One woman dead, one injured, and a police officer, too, shot with his life changed. A lot of details came out this week that we didn't know going into the trial. Let's start it's kind of at the beginning with the crime that happened in 2015.
Sure. For anybody who hasn't been following this, on February 5th, 2015, shortly after 2 a.m. in the morning, Adrian Loya, who was then 31 and a former Coast Guardsman, now information technology specialist, forced his way into a condominium on Roundhouse Road in Bourne, where Lisa and Anna Trubnikova were living or were there at the time. And there was this history with Loya and Lisa Trubnikova in particular. And he, as you said, had apparently, according to affidavits and according to what's come out in court regarding his interview, and his attorney doesn't really dispute the facts of the case. He's really arguing regarding Loya's sanity, essentially. But Loya had planned this attack, which, again, took place really early in the morning. And I remember it distinctly because our reporter, Haven Arecchio-Yersetz, at the time called me because she happened to be listening to the scanner, and she ran out to the scene right there that morning. And it was just, to say it was dramatic and horrific is an understatement. Mm-hmm. A car on fire. There were homemade, what looked like explosives at the time, and that's what police were dealing with. And there was, there was shooting going on, and there had been a shooting. And the Bourne police had responded to this, and in particular, Bourne Police Officer Jared McDonald had responded. And during court testimony this week, he laid out what he had witnessed when he responded. And he ended up getting shot himself. Loya had entered the condominium and had shot both Lisa and Anna Trubnikova. Again, according to the police, but his attorney isn't really disputing this. And again, this case really gets into his motivation and what was behind that shooting as much as anything. And again, whether or not he was sane at the time.
Mm-hmm. So for the past 2.5 years before the trial started, he's been at Bridgewater being held there. And some of the facts that came out this week at the trial, the arresting officers speaking about how calm he was at the time that they arrested him.
Yes, and to quote him in his interview with the investigators, and I believe there's a video of that interview that the jurors heard yesterday, he said very simply, "I murdered a woman, Lisa Berlanga Trubnikova." And again, he said, "And I opened fire on a police officer," all very calm and you know, very collected in some sense. And also, again, the way he set this up in terms of recording them beforehand and kind of tracking their movements, coming several days earlier to the Cape and staying in a hotel,
and
setting up video cameras. It was all very, you know, methodical in many respects. But again, his attorney is certainly raising questions about whether he was sane at the time. And,
well, it sounds
going to be the hinging.
It sounds like he came up. This crime happened in February 2015, but it sounds like now that he came up in October before that to scout the scene and he put a camera in the trees to see if it was the Trubnikova's condominium that he was at.
Yes, and again, that speaks to kind of how much work he put into this, and he actually ended up writing a 250-page essay detailing the reasons that he wanted to kill Lisa Trubnikova. Mm-hmm. And that goes back to an incident that he is claiming that he says was a sexual assault that she, I guess, did to him. And he says that that had really messed him up and in a weird way, is how he put it, really screwed him up in a weird way. And he didn't get a promotion. And there are all these things that he is claiming led to this attack. But as you said, it was something where he was planning it well in advance.
And that sexual assault that he's referring to would have happened in Alaska, he said, 2 years earlier when he was stationed in Alaska, and both Lisa and Anna Trubnikova were there as well, serving in the Coast Guard.
Yeah, and he said he went to, Lisa had invited him to her house. This is, again, what he's saying, to watch movies. He says he got there, she was drunk, tried to kiss him. He said no and tried to stay away. And again, it made him uncomfortable, he said, what was going on. And that apparently set in motion at least this mindset that led to the actions that occurred then 3 years later.
So he actually wore a body camera strapped to his chest when he came into the Bourne condominium and
yes, he did. And I remember as we got affidavits, as documents started to come out shortly after the events of that early morning. And that was one thing that we found out through looking at these affidavits. And we had actually sent a reporter down to Virginia to look at where he was living. And the fact that there were recording equipment. And again, he wore a body camera. I think he tied basically a camera to a tree nearby. And was recording all of this. I don't know what that speaks to in terms of his state of mind, but it certainly speaks to some planning. But whether or not it's something that somebody would say is sane or not sane is something mm-hmm. that the jury is going to have to decide.
Well, as you say, the defense attorney really seems to say there's no argument about guilt in the case. It really is all going to come down to whether he's judged criminally sane. And I guess we're going to hear from mental health experts coming up in the trial.
Yeah, we will. And again, this is Drew Segadelli, who his attorney has made these arguments in other murder cases, and certainly is familiar with making these arguments. But you know, all the factors in each of these cases as they come forward are obviously individual, and it'll be certainly something to watch to see how he makes that argument and how he convinces the jury, or doesn't convince the jury, as the case may be, that his client, you know, whether he deserves to go and be treated, and in some cases that can mean for the rest of his life, depending on how things play out, or deserves to be, you know, sent to prison and spend the rest of his life in prison.
Patrick, before we move on from this, I just want to touch on the officer, Jared McDonald. You guys did a nice profile of him. He's the officer who responded that night and was shot and has had his life changed.
Yes, and certainly, you know, getting shot can't be a pleasant experience. It was obviously, he was one of the first officers on the scene, and from there, he's since retired. He's still dealing with physical issues related to that. After the shooting, certainly the community rallied around him. There was GoFundMe sites set up, and it seems like the community really, you know, came to support him. But, you know, he was certainly one person who was affected by this. Obviously, Lisa Trubnikova died. Anna Trubnikova, her wife, you know, continues, I'm sure, to be affected by this, and as does both their families. It's an event that's going to have repercussions going forward.
And there were witnesses from the condominium community. You can't imagine waking up to something like that in the middle of the night. Going on outside,
and one in particular who he and his wife were asleep at the time, and actually Adrian Loya came to their back porch and I think set one of the guns that he was using down on top of a box that had been for the crib of their child. So again, you can't get any closer and more concerning than that as neighbors.
Let's turn now to Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette, who's joining us as well, and talk about a different story here. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Sarah, your story, you have a story about a proposal from a Vineyard hotel businessman to create a resort-style hotel on the island of Cuttyhunk. And I think this is interesting not only because it deals with development and opportunity and the struggle to preserve a sense of place, but also it all happens on a very small island.
Yeah, very small. You know, Cuttyhunk is our neighbor out to the west, the very end of the tip of the Elizabeth Island chain. It's a very small population. And there are very few commercial enterprises. So this, yeah, absolutely. We're talking about a very small place. And as you said, Mark Snyder, who's a vineyard businessman, and he owns the Winnetou Resort out for Nikitima and the Nantucket Hotel and Resort on Nantucket, he visited Cuttyhunk last summer, I guess, and he saw the Winter House, which is this well-known 100-year-old building. It's kind of situated on a high part of the island, very visible, you know, very beautiful old building. And it was actually built by an Edgartown man, William Wood, as a gift for his son. And it's called the Winter House because it is suitable for year-round living. But it's been shuttered and was empty, and he thought about buying the property and turning it into a resort. And among other things, he said, you know, it would be a boost to the Cuttyhunk economy, and it would update this house, that this historic house that was kind of languishing. But he also said from the beginning, I think, as you said, acknowledging the nature of Cuttyhunk, that this is a small place and there's this effort to kind of preserve it and the sense of community, he said he would only move forward if there was community support for the idea. And as it turns out, there wasn't. there was some passionate dialogue about it, though. It sounds like it was really kind of the talk of the island, at least the last few months.
Well, and what he was proposing was not just refurbishing this one historic house, but really building out quite a good deal more.
I should say his proposal was kind of to, and this is exactly kind of what became the issue, was adding about 30 new rooms, a restaurant, a swimming pool. This would include also getting a liquor license. And so this is would be a big thing. This is a dry island, so a liquor license would be a very big departure. Swimming pools are banned. So that would also be a departure. And also just the size of it, there were concerns about things like the infrastructure and, you know, electricity and wastewater. And also on this small island where there are very few businesses. I think there's a general store, some private inns without restaurants, I guess a school teacher who sells pizzas out of his garage this summer, which was one of my favorite details. So, yeah, so when that's the landscape, something like this would clearly kind of be the dominant thing and also be a pretty big departure from what's there. And it's also, the Winter House is kind of this part of island history, so it would also really change the nature of that building, too. So I think those were all factors in this discussion that kind of ended up with a lot of people saying, I think there was a survey that went out and 10% were in favor and 78% were against. And 300 people took the survey in a day, which doesn't sound like a lot, but we're talking about a really small place. So that is kind of a lot for Cuttyhunk.
And Snyder, the developer, said he wasn't going to go forward with this if the community couldn't get behind it. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah. So he said, he listened to these concerns and said, you know, he didn't want to do it without community support. So he said, you know, he's not pursuing this anymore and has, you know, said he's heard the community and only wanted to do it with community support. So he has backed out, I guess. And but also it's really, you know, it's still on the table, kind of the discussion for the island about not just what's going to happen with the Winter House, which is up for discussion, you know, what they would like to see happen there. But also it's kind of brought up the discussion of the potential benefits of having that not turn into, you know, some kind of year-round business because the population of Cuttyhunk has been dwindling the last few years, year-round population. I think the community has really looked at this as a potential. Some people said this could be a potential for jobs, something that might kind of boost the population, the economy. Mm-hmm. And so I think that discussion about maybe other things to kind of bolster this year-round community and might continue as well. Apparently, I should add, the community really turned out for this, and the meetings were so well attended that they had to move from the town hall to the church first. So clearly, this really got people talking, which is another thing that I think we heard people, the town selectmen, say might be a good thing about this, which is it really brought people together to talk about the future of the island.
So the community of Cuttyhunk says no to a proposed development there. Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you. Bye.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. We're going to go to the break now. When we come back, we're going to hear from Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back to the News Roundup on The Point. We are discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. And joining us on the phone right now from the Cape Cod Chronicle is Tim Wood. Hello, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, a court ruling this week from for Harwich Congregational Church means that it owns the town cemetery.
Yeah, this is involves the cemetery in Harwich Center. Now, for several years, the town and the First Congregational Church there have feuded over a cremation memorial garden that's in part of the cemetery, which is immediately adjacent to the church. When it was approved in 1988, the town understood that this memorial garden was supposed to be for the scattering of ashes only. But since then, more than 140 cremation remains have been buried there. And it was later discovered that the area they were buried were above several unmarked graves. After the town threatened to require that those cremation remains be relocated, the church sued, claiming that they owned the cemetery. And last week, the state land court agreed, citing the original 1743 deed to the property. Which the court said granted the property to the church, not the town. The church continued to use that cemetery all the way through the 1800s, right up until 1938, when the town took over maintenance of all the cemeteries in town. But while the court said while the town might have taken over the maintenance of the cemetery, at no time did the church relinquish its ownership. They allowed the town to maintain the cemetery with their permission, so that the church still retains the ownership. The bottom line is that the church doesn't have to move the memorial garden right now, and church officials can go forward with interring a number of ashes that they've held back pending that decision. Now, the selectmen are expected to discuss this decision on Tuesday and decide if they're going to appeal it, and they also say that they're going to reach out to the church to try to determine how best to move forward with this and continue the possibly continue with town maintenance of that cemetery.
I want to ask you about another story you have, Tim, about the Monomoy School District. This year is undertaking something that a lot of other school districts have looked at and maybe balked at for the logistical difficulties it can create. Monomoy School District is changing the start times of school. How's this working?
Yes, exactly. A number of districts have looked at that. Some have made changes, but Monomoy will be the latest to do that. And they're altering the start times to really in response to what experts say are the sleep patterns of younger children and teenagers. Previously, high school and middle school were the first to start the day, with the elementary school starting later, but that's being flipped, basically, because, as we all know, teenagers tend to sleep later in the day. So they're going to start school later. With the elementary school will be starting at 7:45, and the regional middle and high schools will be beginning their day at 8:45, starting Tuesday when classes return after the summer break. School officials say they understand that the elementary school starting time of 7:45 is quite early. They tried to push that back closer to 8, but that proved impossible given the logistics of the bus schedules, with Harwich and Chatham students going to the middle and high school being gathered from both towns. They needed that 1 hour transportation time to get the kids to school, they say. It's a big adjustment, school superintendent Scott Carpenter said, and is going to require a number of changes, including sports schedules and other aspects of the school day. And it's also going to be a big adjustment for parents, he allowed. You know, they're going to have to get elementary school kids to school pretty early. Elementary kids are going to be ending their day at 2:15, which is pretty early, especially for working parents. They've put a number of after-school programs in place to try to help parents, so some of those are available.
Mm-hmm.
And they to help students or to help parents deal with this and other issues, the Monomoy District has just released a new smartphone app, which provides scheduling, communications, grades, and other information all in one place. They're hoping that parents will be able to use this to help better coordinate their students' days. And that app can be downloaded for free at both the Apple and Google stores.
Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
Patrick Cassidy is with us from the Cape Cod Times. He is on the line. Patrick, I want to turn to Hurricane Harvey. A lot of people in the Cape following this, the devastation in Houston. At Otis Air National Guard Base, they're really following it very closely.
Yeah, this is the 102nd Intelligence Wing of the Air National Guard. And as it turns out, the commander of that wing, Virginia Dunan, is actually a Houston native. And so she says she's been following the events down in Houston very closely, obviously from a personal standpoint. But the 102nd is also very heavily involved and started basically essentially doing what they do, usually in wartime situations, but analyzing data and images coming out of Houston in this case, obviously not a wartime situation, but a crisis nonetheless. And they're analyzing that data and looking at the flooding using basically commercial satellites and things of that nature to try and get information to local authorities so that they can then act on that information. So they're obviously, again, following that closely. And it's really very interesting and speaks to the times a bit that you have a unit here on the Cape that's looking at data and images and then sending information down to Texas, back down to Texas, so that people can act on that information. And certainly they're not alone. The Coast Guard Air Station Cape Cod has a number of resources down there, helicopters, a fixed-wing airplane, and I think they had 25 members as of earlier this week who were down there, and you've seen them on TV basically doing what they do, which is hoisting people off of whether it's rooftops or from areas that are flooded and moving them to safer ground.
I did think it was an interesting peek at what goes on at Otis, that they're able to stream live video from these satellites and from the air and really get detailed information about search and rescue efforts.
Absolutely. And we've done stories on them. Our reporter Christine Legere had done a story just a couple months ago, I believe, where she looked at how that works. Again, looking at the Middle East, Afghanistan, situations like that, where you're obviously getting that information and then using it for wartime situations. In this case, obviously, it's a domestic crisis, and they're able to turn around and do this in a domestic way that is able to help, again, local authorities deal with a situation that for some may seem like war in some respects.
Andy Tomolonis is joining us right now from the New Bedford Standard Times and South Coast Today. Good morning, Andy.
Hey, Steve.
Andy, Carlos Rafael, the so-called godfather of New Bedford, is back in the news this week. There's two different stories here, both of them significant.
Well, yes, it's interesting. In background, I know we all know Carlos Rafael in New Bedford. He's the godfather. He owns fishing boats, and Carlos Seafood is a longtime fixture on the New Bedford waterfront, and he was indicted and charged, and he's awaiting sentencing. What he did was misrepresent the types of fish he was catching, and he was selling these fish on the black market in New York and smuggling money to Portugal. So in that investigation, an officer in the Bristol County Sheriff's Department was charged with helping him. And now there's a second officer in the sheriff's department who's been charged, Jamie Mello of Dartmouth. He was arrested Wednesday. He's charged with bulk smuggling cash and structuring and conspiracy. And it was less than 2 months after a federal jury found Antonio Freitas, the other deputy sheriff at Bristol County, guilty of aiding Rafael in a similar scheme.
So it's two sheriff's office employees helping this fellow smuggle cash out of the country.
Yes, yes. So we'll wait to see what happens with the second set of charges, but this is out of the U.S. Attorney's Office. So it's interesting. Now, we talked to Bristol County Sheriff Tom Hodgson yesterday, and he said, to his knowledge, there's no one else who's being investigated, and he says he's been fully cooperative with the investigation since its beginning. He did say that, that it's not a reflection of everyone else on the staff, but it certainly doesn't make the employees in the sheriff's department feel good because they pride themselves in setting high standards. And that's what he told our reporters.
Now, briefly, Andy, Rafael is widely expected to forfeit his fishing business, including the boats and the quota. But this week, his wife kind of stepped forward and said, not so fast.
Yes. I don't know if we can call her the cod mother, but it's a case of where she wants to claim 50% of the boats and funding that Carlos has. So his property is being married. She wasn't involved in any of the illegal activities and says that she is entitled to that.
Hmm. Andy Tomalonis of the New Bedford Standard-Times and South Coast Today. Andy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Patrick Cassidy is with us from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, you have a strong article detailing some of the impact of opioid death rates on first responders and public health officials.
Yeah, obviously, and unfortunately, this is nothing new in recent years that there's been a rise in deaths from opioid use, heroin, fentanyl, and those types of drugs. But what we noticed a week or two ago is we thought we were hearing more and more on the scanner about responses to fatal overdoses locally, and we checked in with local police departments, and there's a lag time certainly in getting kind of hard data on how many deaths have occurred. But in the police departments that we checked with and fire departments that we checked with, they said, yeah, it does seem like there was maybe a spike about a week ago over the weekend. Where in a two-day span there were four unattended deaths that Cape officials suspected were overdoses, and possibly as many as six during one day, according to police in Barnstable. So they were looking at that and saying that seemed high. Almost at the same time, the state released the latest figures, and it seemed to indicate that deaths from opioid overdoses had dropped off slightly from last year. And again, this is all relative because we're talking about a high number of deaths last year, and in 2016, for example, there were 2,107 opioid-related overdose deaths. The statewide estimate of a 978 deaths for the first half of 2017, and again, just think about those numbers a bit, is down 5% from the same period last year. A lot of folks look at Narcan and those types of things that help in reducing that. But again, local police and fire departments are saying, well, the deaths may be down, but we do feel like we're just going out steadily on overdoses. And, you know, I could point to yesterday and listening to the scanner and hearing, I think it was down in Yarmouth going out to a reported overdose. It seems like we hear it, every couple of hours here as we're sitting in the newsroom. And certainly they're dealing with it on the front lines, the police and fire departments. And say it's not really abating. It's just you may have changed the game a little bit with the deaths dropping off because of the use of Narcan, but there's still 978 deaths across the state in the first half of this year, which is phenomenal and unbelievable.
Let's turn to Ann Wood of the Provincetown Banner, who joins us now. Ann, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. And despite a fight from neighbors, Provincetown is getting a medical marijuana dispensary. Tell us where it's going.
Finally, a medical marijuana dispensary. Provincetown's last funeral home is going to pot. The Gately McCool Funeral Home at 94 Harry Kemp Way is going to be turned into a medical marijuana facility starting in about mid-2018. And it is the last funeral home in town that's basically held funerals for everyone from Pulitzer Prize-winning author Norman Mailer to iconic doorman Eddie Ritter. The closest funeral home is in Wellfleet. It would be Nickerson's funeral home. So that's going to be a big loss for the town, but having a medical marijuana dispensary here finally is going to be good for the town, although some residents of that area are fighting against it because it's in a mixed-use area. So they've actually petitioned a special town meeting that would ask the town to change it so the pot dispensaries can only be located in commercial areas. But because this has already been approved by the planning board, this is going to go through. It will be in this mixed-use area in Harry Kemp Way in the funeral home.
Hmm.
It was conditioned, though. You want to know about that?
Well,
the planning board let this Heal Inc. come in and open up this place with the condition that it will never sell recreational pot.
Okay, well, that's important for the neighbors to know as well.
Right.
I also want to make sure we have time for you to talk about this other story you have, which is about a new logo for the town and some of the controversy this may have created.
Oh, let me first describe this logo. It is the shape of the outer cape, and it's a rainbow-colored shape of the outer cape. It looks like it's washed with watercolors, and it's got a Provincetown script across it, and below it, it says, "You belong here." It looks like something that should really be on a tourist coffee mug.
But that's what anyway, a logo is, right? It belongs on a coffee mug, kind of.
It looks like it belongs on a coffee mug instead of the town stationery where it is now being used as a tourism marketing plug. What happened was the Visitor Service Board, which oversees the tourism department in town, hired Nadine Lacoste of Red Thread Productions to come up with a tagline for Provincetown, this logo. The logo, however, is being seen as exclusive by some because it looks like it's only marketing to gay tourists and not to people in general. And at first, she said, well, obviously, it's a watercolor mark, and it's meant to signify the artist community in town. But then she backpedaled and admitted that it's really gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer symbol, and that she thinks it's the beacon of our identity here. Members of the Board of Selectmen, even one who is gay, was like, I don't think this is a great idea using rainbow colors because it becomes, you know, exclusionary. And other people on the Visitor Service Board didn't really like it either, even though it's going forth because it got a 4-2 vote in favor of the design. Susan Avalar says it doesn't represent Provincetown history, especially in light of the 400th commemoration of the Pilgrims Landing here in 2020, and said it looks like it's used to represent a particular group of people, mm-hmm. not a heterogeneous group of people, and she's not sure it's entirely inclusive of all the people that visit here and that it represents the community.
And what happens, what happens now with it?
Well, they're using it, so the day after this happened, which was Monday, the tourism department actually started using the logo. Now, they can change it. They're saying this is, you know, something that has been approved and they're going to start using it. But I think if a lot of people decide they don't like it, they can say that they're not going to use it anymore. The town's actually paying for this logo, paying for Lacoste to come up with this logo. She has a 3-year contract for $38,000, but can also spend up to $70,000 a year on ad designs, marketing, and materials. And a lot of people, not everyone, didn't like the You Belong Here tagline anyway, but now with this rainbow arm symbol and the Provincetown script with the You Belong Here, some people think it seems very exclusive and not welcoming to the straight people. Not that this is a gay straight thing at all. In this community, doesn't matter. We love everybody, but they feel like it's marketing just to the gay population, which is only about half the people who come here.
It's you can understand why it's a fraught conversation there. Ann Wood from Provincetown Banner, thank you for joining us.
Take care.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, it's Patrick Cassidy. We're going to go to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from a little more from Patrick and from George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back to the local news roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. Patrick, last week we had a suggestion from a Barnstable County commissioner on how to address the numbers of great white sharks we're seeing. Ron Beatty wanted to bait hooks to catch and kill the sharks. It's not met with a lot of enthusiasm. This week we see a new idea. It's a little unexpected. It's a proposal for how to track these sharks.
Well, and just to take, you know, some issue with the unexpected nature of any of this, not on your part, but on Mr. Beatty's part or anybody's part, we've been covering this, and in particular, reporter Doug Frazier has been covering this issue for years and years and years and years. We've had stories about, you know, this particular idea in terms of the balloons. This newest portion of that idea is to set up this 15-balloon system where video cameras would be hanging from these balloons, and it would cover one large stretch of beach, the Outer Cape, essentially, where the majority of the interactions with sharks take place.
About 40 miles of the Outer Cape.
It is. It goes from Provincetown all the way down to, you know, Monomoy, which is obviously the hot area for sharks, and even into Nantucket Sound in order to get the overlap that they're looking for. And essentially, they're claiming that it would provide one more or less continuous video coverage of all these areas. There's an expense. It's not cheap. One of these units is $5,000 to $6,000. I'm sure there's maintenance costs. We haven't gotten a an exact figure for how much the entire system would cost, but obviously the towns and the seashore would have to pick up this cost in some way. But again, obviously this issue took on, you know, a heightened sense of urgency because of Mr. Beatty's comments. He's a Barnesville County Commissioner, for anybody who's not aware. There was an attack on a seal off Nauset Beach in Orleans last week that got a lot of attention, and then a paddleboarder had his board bitten off Falston Beach last week as well, which lent even more urgency, I suppose, to this. But I guess it's important to point out Mr. Beatty is a county commissioner. There's no jurisdiction that the county commissioners hold over this, and the reaction has actually been vociferous by folks who are worried about shark populations and environmentalists largely in opposition to this. Scientists, you know, are saying, well, you know, we've looked at all these types of things. And again, going back, we had a story in January that included discussion of barrel baiting. But for whatever reason, last week when Mr. Beatty brought this up, it became something that folks latched onto and reacted to. And you know, it'd be interesting to know, and I don't know the answer to this. There's been working groups that have been meeting for I think a year at least, that include the seashore, the towns, and they've been meeting, I think, quarterly to discuss various ways to address this issue and to either, you know, monitor the sharks, try and track them, try and figure out where they are, try and obviously protect people on the beaches. And I'm not sure if he attended any of those meetings, to be honest with you, but there's scientists who have been looking at this. And there's also a number of laws that are in place protecting sharks. There's a discussion about seals that's going on. So all of this discussion that's been going on for years, you know, came to a bit of a head. And, you know, this company that produces these balloons and these video cameras certainly, I think, saw an opportunity and you know, nothing against them, but they saw an opportunity here where they said, well, we have this potential solution, or at least something that can help get you video and photos of sharks as they move through the waters and come close to the beaches where visitors are. People have said, scientists, people with knowledge have certainly agreed that it seems inevitable that at one point somebody is going to certainly get bit again. There was a man who was bit several years ago off Truro by a shark, but that a fatality may certainly be coming down the road, you know, just because of the number of people in the water, the number of sharks that have showed up here chasing the seals, the number of seals. But again, there's lots of different ways that people are trying to address baiting the sharks close to the beach has a myriad of questions that are raised by that, whether you're attracting the sharks to the beach, whether it actually works. There's various studies that have looked at this in various locations, South Africa, Australia, with mixed results. So it's something that I'm sure people will be looking at and considering, but I'm not sure a county commissioner is the one to weigh in on this.
George Brennan is on the phone. I want to get to George. George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Hi, Steve. How are you today?
Doing well. George, this summer we heard a lot about a visa program called H-2B. Federal cutbacks to those visas resulted in area businesses losing a lot of their seasonal workforce, hit a lot of businesses hard. Now this week, we've heard about cuts to another different visa program. Tell us what this is about.
Yeah, this is a J-1 visa program, and this is largely student visitors come to the Cape and Islands, and they come here to get a little bit of cultural experience and work at the same time. Many of them work in the service industry, similar to H-2B visa workers. But interestingly about this program is they're not tied to one specific place when they come, and you might see J-1 visa workers working multiple places, maybe at a coffee shop, one shift, and then maybe later on at a hotel or something like that. Cuts to this program would be devastating to island businesses who rely on these foreign workers for jobs, frankly, that United States citizens aren't willing to do. We spoke to one business owner. 100% of his staff that clean rooms are foreign workers. He says he's never gotten any applicant from the United States for any of those jobs when they're posted. So obviously it would be devastating to his business, but others as well who rely heavily, especially, of course, during the tourist season for these workers.
Patrick, I know you also covered this story, the J-1 visa program, your paper.
Yeah, obviously it's a Cape and Islands issue, and a large number of J-1 workers do come here to work for the summer. I think it was 4,600 some odd workers here in 2016 from this program out of about 100,000 in the United States. I heard certainly Wendy Northcross, the CEO of the Chamber of Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce, talking to Catherine Iden with WCII there earlier this morning about how that represents 31% of the Cape's total peak labor force. Mm-hmm. And if you were to remove that from the labor force in the midst of the summer, you would really not only certainly affect those workers. Her argument is, and business leaders' argument is, that you'd affect the businesses themselves, and that would affect American workers, which is kind of the whole point of the Trump administration's push to limit some of these programs, is to care for American jobs. So the counter argument is obviously that the jobs that you're trying to protect will be affected if you reduce these workers that come here, certainly to the Cape and Islands, for peak workforce needs.
George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, I want to thank you. You also have a nice story in the paper that people can go check out about what would happen if hurricane preparedness here on the vineyard, and what would happen if we get one. Folks should check that out. George Brennan, thanks so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
Patrick Cassidy with the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, let's talk ticks. Yeah, and you profiled the testing facility where they receive the ticks that people mail in. This is an interesting story.
Yeah, this was a facility that's in Amherst where they are testing these ticks. It's been something where folks from Cape Cod and I think the islands can send ticks there at a discounted rate. The rate would normally be higher, but through some funding from Cape Cod Hospital, they can send the ticks there. And
so if you get a tick bite, you can pull off the tick and you can put it in an envelope, mail it to these folks, and they'll tell you whether it was carrying some of the tick-borne illnesses.
Yeah, we're talking Lyme disease, we're talking anaplasmosis, there's all sorts of Powassan. These are diseases that some of them are relatively new to some people. And we also had another story about one of the diseases that folks may not be aware of, Borrelia miyamotoi, however you pronounce it. It was just recently found in the United States, but also is starting to show up apparently on the Cape. We talked to an individual from Harwich. He's actually a nurse, and he said he had seen patients with symptoms of Lyme disease and other tick-borne diseases. But this was one he wasn't aware of, and when he became sick with it, he didn't know really what was going on, but he ended up in the hospital for 4 days, so it's something that can really affect you, and certainly in some cases can be something that's even more deadly. He certainly survived, and maybe that had to do with his age at 37, and apparently otherwise healthy. So there have only been 28 confirmed probable cases of this particular disease in Massachusetts since 2014. None have been reported in Barnstable County. Obviously, he had it, so there's this lag time in terms of reporting and the data being brought by the state from the local authorities or through the reporting method, however that is. Clearly, it's here, and it's another disease to watch out for, and another reason why folks may want to be sending their ticks off to this program and getting them tested.
Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station is seeing another inspection coming up this month. A regulator who's been particularly critical of the plant is playing a big role here.
Yeah, this is Don Jackson. He's the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's Northeast Region Chief of Operations. And your listeners may remember that back earlier this year, in December, he had sent an email that actually came to us, and it was an internal email, but that apparently was sent to some of the wrong people and ended up getting out there, in which he was critical of the operations there at Pilgrim, saying that they seemed to be overwhelmed at times by trying to run the plant there in Plymouth. They've had a number of issues, as everybody's aware. They're closing down in 2019, but this most recent basically inspection, or it's a requalification exam for the plant's operators that's coming up this month, the week of September 24th, will look at how the operators are functioning. And as part of that, they have to go back and essentially explain the mistakes that have been made in recent years. And that goes back to a point where the plant was degraded in terms of how it was doing to kind of one of the three worst plants as far as operations go in the country. So Donald Jackson, who doesn't always come on these types of routine inspections, otherwise routine inspections, says he plans to be here with the inspectors in Plymouth. He obviously has an interest in how they're doing in terms of correcting some of the errors that have been made and making sure things are running smoothly. Obviously, with that plant, there are two issues at hand. The plant's age, it's 40 plus 45 years old, and again, will be closing down in 2019. And also, you know, basically operator error that has occurred. So you got maintenance issues, but you also got operators who have made mistakes over the years.
And advocates concerned that as they're moving towards shutdown, they might be they might have even less resources to give toward the plant.
That's true, and obviously, you know, there may be a less attention as they're moving towards shutdown. And then there's post-shutdown operations that they have to deal with, and that's certainly nothing to sneeze at. There's spent nuclear waste there that is going to have to be protected and cared for, and that's a whole other discussion that's going on at the federal and state level with an advisory commission that's looking at those issues as well.
Patrick, I want to jump ahead now to a story about you see folks on the beaches with metal detectors, and this week you have a nice story about a discovery made on a beach that ended up putting a happy ending to a story that's 47 years old. Explain this for us.
Yeah, so put it in context, 2 years before the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station came online, Patrick O'Hagan and his then-wife Christine Kell O'Hagan were on a Dennisport beach. They'd come from New York on their honeymoon, and he was swimming in the water, and he came out of the water and said to her that he had lost a ring. It was a class ring that she had put money aside from her telephone operating position to buy for him, and certainly meant a lot to them at the time. So he lost this ring in 1970, and it was earlier this summer that James Wirth, who's from California, was out in the water with his metal detector looking around on that beach, and he found that ring again. He was able to match it up with the O'Hagans by looking at the inscription, which actually had O'Hagan's name, full name on it, and an E. Wirth, who's done this before, has found rings before and tracked down the owners of those rings, said he pretty easily turned to Google and was able to find this book that Kell O'Hagan had written. And in that book, it mentioned Patrick O'Hagan, and he said, "I know that's the guy because it says he's a budding electrical engineer," and there was an E on the ring that indicated as much. Contacted them in New York and was able to clean the ring up and get it back to them. So it was certainly a happy ending for them. They said they could have gotten a new one, but having the original is really something special.
It is a marvel to think of this ring 47 years somewhere on the beach, and the fellow who found it saying that he swept that beach many times before and just new things keep turning up.
Absolutely. And yeah, we always see these folks with metal detectors out there, and every once in a while one of these stories pops up, and it's obviously the reason they keep going out.
Well, that is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Thanks for joining us, Patrick.
Thanks, Steve.
I want to thank our other contributors, Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle, Andy Tomolonis of South Coast Today, Ann Wood of the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.
The Friday News Roundup is produced by Steve Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.